age young men it is going to be leading those songs?
Fifth and sixth grade.
Be interesting, won't it? There are a number of Bible statements or phrases that I find really fascinating. And I'm sure you say the same thing as you read, you're reading through your Bible. In fact, this year I'm reading through a completely different version than I've ever read before, just so that I'll read through and say different words than what I expected to say. It's kind of interesting what jumps out at you. This one I'm reading through is a little bit more modern version. And each time I read through, there's a phrase or two, or actually a lot more than one or two, that jump out at me that I think, boy, that'd really make a neat sermon, or at least devotional thought. One of them that I find fascinating, I've always found fascinating, is in Psalm 56:8. And it says, "Put my tears in your bottle. Put my tears in your bottle." David is complaining there in that psalm about those who are pursuing him. More modern versions say something like, "You have put my tears in your bottle. You have written everyone in your book." That'd make it's a fascinating thought to hold on to, that whenever you're in difficult times, that God captures every one of your tears, isn't it? It's a comforting thought to think that He has written down and recorded every one of your tears in His book. It's a very comforting thought, and it certainly brings to mind that God is very, very concerned about your feelings and about pain and struggles when you're involved in it. And that really captures my imagination. Another one that's always been a favored one of mine is because when I was a small child, in fact, the first sermon that I can ever recall personally my dad preaching was at a family reunion, and not very many of his family were members of the church, and they asked him to preach at a family reunion. Now, people don't usually get that request at a family reunion, I'm sure, but I remember that he preached on something that fascinated even a little kid. And it was based in Jeremiah 12:9, and God is responding to Jeremiah's questioning regarding the desolation of Zion in Babylonian captivity. And he says, "Has not my inheritance like a speckled bird of prey that other birds of prey are attacking on every side?" And he preached a sermon entitled "The Speckled Bird." And as a kid, you know, I mean, I've seen, and you have seen, a mockingbird chasing a crow across the horizon and just won't quit. Sometimes a couple of them, because the crow has threatened her nest, and a small bird is pecking away at that bird as he's flying away. So that brought that to mind, even as a small kid. And there's lots of others that you have, some that have stuck out in your mind or that you have done some thinking about. One of the statements that is likely more familiar than perhaps these two that comes to my mind anyway is regarding David's statement, or God's statement about David, recorded in Acts chapter 13, verse 22, when he refers to David as a man after my own heart. It intrigues me to wonder exactly why God referred to David in this manner. And I know that some of you are attending a class that David Singletary is teaching right now, entitled something like "David, a Man After God's Own Heart." And so I'm sure that you're discussing this regularly. We in our Thursday class have been on David's life for a long time, suffice it to say. We don't move real rapidly in that class. So we've been pretty well picking apart David's life for the last several months, actually. And there have been times in my life when I run across something about David that I think, okay, that's why. God said that. And then there are also times that I have sat down and written out various things about David that I feel like perhaps caused God to say this about him. But certainly, I think one of the primary reasons he gives after, in that very context there, he says, he's a man after my own heart who will do all my will. So certainly that has to be the foundation of why God would call David a man after his own heart. David was such a good older man because he was such a good young man. And as we look at his life when he was young, I'm impressed with just about everything that I read about him when he was young. You read about the faith that he expressed as he faced Goliath. He seemed to have absolutely no fear about that. He seemed very confident about how this was going to turn out. And in fact, it did turn out that way. His devotion to Saul, whenever Saul called him and talked to his father and said, I want him to be my special servant, then he had a special devotion to Saul. And that devotion to Saul continued throughout his whole life. His unwillingness to raise his hand against the Lord's anointed, even when Saul was pursuing him, trying to kill him. And if anybody ever had a right to kill somebody, from a human standpoint, he had every right to kill Saul, didn't he? But he never would. And under no conditions would he. And regardless of what Saul had done to him, he had absolute trust in God and the fact that God would, in his own time, take care of this situation. He truly taught us what it is to wait on the Lord. And so everything that I see about his young life, his humility whenever he was confronted with his sin, he had no defense. He didn't blame anybody else. He didn't say, yes, I did that, but he just accepted the consequences of his sin. So many things in his life which demonstrated his love for and his devotional to God and to God's purposes and a sense of mission that he had about himself. Even though he certainly as a young man didn't see himself as king, then he saw himself as a servant of God every moment of his life, it seems to me. And one would think that God would spare such a man the really devastating circumstances in life. That if somebody had that much love for and devotion to God, then God would kind of smooth out his life a bit. But one of the other things that I've learned as we've studied and been reminded of as we've studied through the life of David recently is that if I ever had any notion of envying David in his life, I don't have it anymore. I don't want David's life. I would not want to have to go through even a fraction of what David went through in his life. I want to look at one such illustration that God used, obviously, these difficulties in David's life to mold him into being the kind of man that he wanted him to be. And I know that these kind of things are easy to say, but they're really difficult whenever it comes to my life and the difficulties happen in my life. Then it's really hard to see that there could be anything really constructive that could possibly come out of this. But if you look at David's life, there are not many times that we have anything recorded, any incident recorded in his life, when we can see very much sense out of it. When it does appear that, yes, this is the kind of thing that David deserves in his life. David became, I think, without question, one of God's greatest servants. And he did because of the attitude that he maintained through incredible, incredible difficulties in his life. And I want to look at just one such incident in David's life. The story is found in 1 Samuel chapter 30 in the background of being a couple of chapters prior to that. You're familiar with the background. I've entitled this lesson, Disaster at Ziklag. David had been privately anointed by Samuel already and told that he was going to be the king, but not many people knew about that. But Saul became suspicious because God had already told Saul that he had rejected him, and he had rejected him in favor of a man that was better than he was. And so Saul was on the lookout for whoever that was that might think that he was a better man than he was. And suspicions obviously began to arise, particularly when he sent David out to war and he would come back and the maidens would sing that Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Well, certainly he must have suspected, you know, this kid, he might be the one here that God has chosen. But he immediately became a target for Saul's jealous rage, and he learned how to dodge javelins well early. And in desperation, he fled to, of all places, when Saul began to determine that he was going to kill him, of all places, he fled to Philistia. Now, if there was one enemy of God's people that you would pick throughout the whole Old Testament, it would have to be Philistia. They constantly fought against Israel. They were Israel's arch enemy. The Philistine king, David, gained his trust so much, and he was so flattered that David had come over to his side, and he certainly saw advantages to having this fierce warrior who had the reputation of having slain his tens of thousands. Then the king was really favorable toward David. Enough time had passed that David had brought 600 men with him, by the way. And David said, I don't really like living here in your palace, but I would like to be, if you could give us a place somewhere on the outlying area here. We're country boys and we do better in the country. And so he gave him the city of Ziklag. And David and his 600 men are going to live there for 16 months. During this time, David is going to go out privately on raids against Israel's enemies. And one of those enemies that he is going to, I guess you could say, rile up, is going to be a group that God had told Saul to absolutely destroy. You remember who that was? Utterly destroy the Amalekites. And Saul had not done that. The Amalekites had come back or were strong enough by that time that a day came whenever the Philistines were going to war against Israel. The king came to David and he said, okay, it's time for you to get your men together, muster your men, and come and fight with us. And David said, oh, that's good. Now you're going to find out. It was kind of an ambiguous statement that he made. He said, you're going to find out now what we can do. And so he and his men marched out with all the Philistines, and as they were passing in parade, then all of a sudden, the Philistine generals noticed his band, and they questioned the king about what they were doing there. And he said, he's shown himself to be trustworthy in everything. I have complete trust in him. I have no problem. I ask him to come here. And the Philistine generals got together and they said, we don't want him. We're not going to fight with him at our back, because he will take this opportunity to ingratiate himself with his past king in Israel, and we'll be fighting in the front, and all of a sudden they're going to be sticking us in the back. We're not going with them, and you're not going to take them. And so the king finally capitulated to his generals, and he said, okay, came to David, and he said, I'm sorry about this, but they're not going to let you go, so you're going to have to go back home. Well, it took them about 3 days to march back home, and when they got back home, disaster had struck. The Amalekites had struck Ziklag, and they had taken away every living thing and burned the city to the ground. They had completely decimated it. And it's really just a note of interest, if you like this kind of thing. This battle that is about to come to pass between the Philistines and Israel is going to be the battle in which Saul and Jonathan are going to be killed. And that makes me think a little bit. I wonder what David would have done had he been in that battle. I think I know. I don't know for sure. But regardless of what I may think, I'll never know, because God spared David from having to participate in that battle. And when David and his men have not been allowed to go to battle, they come back, and now they are being put to a test unlike any test they've ever been put to before. And there was no warning for this test. There was no way to prepare for what's about to happen to them. Now David's career and his future are unexpectedly put on the line. He's been fleeing and for his life for a long time now. But now the scene has changed. And it came to pass, when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had invaded the south in Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burned it with the fire, and had taken the women captives that were therein. They did not kill any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captive. Now, how do you respond to a situation like that? How do you react when everything's been taken away from you? He hasn't had a lot for the last number of months, has he? But at least he's had the closest people in this world around him. He's had his family around him. In fact, his mother and his father had gone with him. And now his brothers, his wives, every one of them gone. And they reacted as you would expect, understandably. David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. I can't imagine the sound of 600 soldiers crying until they couldn't cry anymore. And I hope to never have to know that sound. They cried until they were numb from grief, and they just couldn't cry anymore. But now David is certainly lost what everyone else has lost, but now it's about to get even worse. And David's two wives were taken, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved for every man, for his sons and for his daughters. Not only did David have to deal with his own personal grief and his own personal loss, but now you add to that the combined losses of his men, that not only did he lose his family, but they lost all of their family, and now they're looking for somebody to blame. And there's not anybody else around to blame. Who's to blame? Well, their leader is. He's the most likely target. And I think back in his life, facing Goliath was one thing, but dealing with 600 angry, grief-stricken soldiers is another thing. And to be completely without anyone now, no one in all the world, he's completely, completely alone. There's nobody on his side. There's nobody for him to go to. It looks like David is done for. 600 angry men against one man. There's no way out of this. Now, I want to stop right here and make an observation. I believe that it's very possible, even highly likely, that every follower of God will face our Ziklag in some form or other. No two are the same. But I find it very difficult to believe that any of us as a Christian will live very long without facing some type of calamity along these lines. The things that you hold most dear will be endangered, perhaps taken away, and you'll have to make a choice at that time. Will you get bitter? Or will you get better? 600 men chose to get bitter. One man chose to get better. You see, God's leaders are made in just such occasions. David could have said, and must have felt at least somewhat like saying, I thought God had called me, but maybe I misunderstood. I thought that I was to be the anointed king of Israel, and I've been trying my best to serve him, and I've given up so much at this point already, and I've tried to leave everything in God's hands, but now it's a complete disaster. I've seen nothing but trouble, and I've been troubled far beyond my limits of my ability. I'm just at the end, and I just can't take any more. I've lost my family. I've lost everything that I've had. And now the people that have followed me now want to stone me. I quit. Just let me die in peace. Maybe I'll have some peace after I've died. Ziklag can either be your graveyard or your finest hour. It's your choice. What did David do? Well, I like the way the King James says it. It says David encouraged himself. But it has some more on the end, but I want to stop right there and say nothing has changed. The next verse says David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Nothing has changed. The situation is still the same. The men are just as mad, perhaps madder, getting closer to stoning him. And in a similar situation, we might call on a trusted friend for help and encouragement and counsel and advice. But David had nobody. There was no one that he could call. But David encouraged himself. Since so many people are takers and not givers, you can't depend on other people to encourage you in this life. It's an unspeakable blessing to have a friend who is consistently there to encourage you. But you can't always depend on other people to encourage you, because there will be times when they're just simply not there. You have to learn to encourage yourself as a Christian, as a follower of the Lord. There may be times in your life when you find absolutely nothing encouraging in your circumstances, when your enemy says, you're done for. I've got you. I've won. When your friends forsake you and people say, well, it's your fault. You're just getting what you deserve after all. And when your circumstances say, there's no way out of this, you might as well give up. You'll never get out of this alive. Job, his wife, everything he had taken away. Friends saying, you didn't get nearly what you deserved. His wife, the only one left for him, says, why don't you just curse God and die? Disaster at Ziklag when you're all alone. You're going to have to encourage yourself. You're going to have to find courage from some other source. David found his strength in the Lord his God. How do you think he did that? What do you think he did? I mean, he's there. The 600 men still want to stone him. The rubble is still smoking. All of their families are gone. The only smell he can smell is the stench of the fire. And maybe the anger of those men. And I wonder what he drew on to find that strength, that courage. That encouragement. I wonder if it was maybe a song he had written that he remembered. I wonder if it was a special scripture that he had available to him. I wonder if it was something that he had confessed. I wonder if it was a promise that God had made that he remembered. Maybe he remembered Goliath and how God had come through on that occasion. Maybe he remembered how many times God had saved him, even though it's just by the skin of his teeth. Maybe he remembered the lion and the bear. I don't know. I don't know what he called on for encouragement. The scripture doesn't tell us. But here's what I do know. And here's what I want you to know. If David could encourage himself in such stressful circumstances, so can you, and so can I. It's a matter of trust. It's a matter of trusting God. That's why the Apostle Paul, who was often in impossible situations and friendless, could say, "When I'm weak, then I'm strong." Rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. It is God who works in you. And he will complete his good work that he has begun in you. All things are working together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. You see, it's not really about you and your circumstances. It's about him. It always has been. And it always will be. Regardless of your circumstances and regardless of how hopeless they may appear and how friendless you may be, the battle always, always, always belongs to the Lord. And he can make it turn out any way he chooses. Regardless of what the situation and the circumstances say. Regardless of how hopeless it may feel and how dark the night may be. It's like Paul said, it is from faith unto faith. It starts and ends in faith. It's all about faith and trusting God. When David encouraged himself in the Lord and asked God what to do, God said, "Pursue them, you'll overcome them, and you'll recover everyone and everything without fail." And he did. So David wiped away his tears, picked up his sword, called to his 600 men, angry men, led them into battle, defeated the enemy, recovered all. And God used the rubble of Ziklag to teach David another lesson about how much he could be trusted. Don't allow Ziklag to become your final resting place. You see, because it's only the testing place of God's people while we stand and sing.